Welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show, where we explore spiritual ideas and books that help you live a better life. Hosted by spiritual teacher and author of If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate, Jason Napolitano.
All right. Hello. Welcome to the Cosmic Eye Podcast. We are here every Sunday with a new episode. And this week we're going to be speaking about meditation disciplines and personal integration by Manly P. Hall. And we're doing parts 3 and 4. Last week, Chris and I did parts 1 and 2. So go back and check that out if you want to listen to that. Of course, we have a new podcast up every Sunday. So there's 3 on there now. And I encourage you to go back and check those out. As I said, my co-host is Chris Sheridan. He is on the phone right now. Go ahead and introduce yourself there, Chris.
Well, thanks, Jason. I'm Chris Sheridan, and we have known each other a long time and have long studied metaphysics and Manly Hall and the works of many others. I just published a book called The Spirit in the Sky. It's a memoir about an experience I had in a plane crash a number of years ago. And this is really great being involved with this podcast and talking about the subject that has been such an interest of mine for so many years.
Absolutely. You and me both. And we met each other at the Philosophical Research Society, as we talked about before, Manly Hall's organization in Los Angeles, which is still functioning today. And that was a real blessing for us to be able to spend some time there and learn more about Mr. Hall and his work. I have a book out right now called If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate. And you can find that on Amazon or on my website called cosmiceye.org. And Chris's book is available on Amazon as well. And you can find that information at chrissheridan.com. So now that we've got our plugs out of the way, we can jump right into Meditation Disciplines and Personal Integration. A fantastic book. I love this. I love this little pamphlet, and I'm really happy that we did this in two parts because it really is such a rich little book. There's so much to it that it needs reading several times to really get all that you can out of it. Would you agree with that?
Well, definitely, and that's a hallmark of a lot of Manly Hall's works is that he does pack a lot of information. It's very dense. So you could read a paragraph or two and just go, wait a minute, think about that for a while. It's plowing ahead to get to the next paragraph or chapter isn't really an advantage. It's probably better to take bites of it or read it once and then go back and really kind of pick it apart because there's just so many gems in there. And he covers a lot of ground in surprising depth for how relatively small. This is under 100 pages.
Yeah,
it's quite a bit of information.
76 pages total, and it feels like a 300-page book. I mean, when you start digging into it, and that's a great point you bring up. It, you know, the thing that's so great about this book is it becomes like a meditative exercise, the reading of it. In other words, like taking those chunks and going slowly through and contemplating them and really taking the time to be mindful of what's going on as you're thinking about them and being really focused on this text is a form of contemplation or meditation. And the book can be used as an aid to concentration and meditation, which is a fantastic way to use it. Plus, it's got some great images in there that you can use as well. So I like that quite a bit about this. One thing I wanted to get into about this book, and we talked about this a bit earlier before the show, is mysticism. I think sometimes the idea of mysticism or the word mystic and the ideas associated with that are misunderstood today. So I wanted to give a real quick definition, and then I want to have you speak on this a bit. My main understanding of mysticism is that it's a belief that there's a union or an absorption into God or the absolute possible, and that this is attainable through spiritual insight or contemplation or meditation. And mysticism is the path at which one becomes absorbed in God. One discovers the divinity within, and the two become one. That's sort of my little understanding of it. But one other interesting thing, and we can talk about this a little bit after you give your idea or definition, but Google, the second definition they have up there is it's a belief characterized by self-delusion or dreamy confusion of thought, especially when based on the assumption of occult qualities or mysterious agencies. And I find that mysticism, much like the word myth, which has been bastardized and destroyed to mean false or unreal, they're taking mysticism to mean, and they're, you know how they put the sentence afterwards as well to sort of describe the meaning of it. It was something about the book title was imbued with New Age mysticism or something along these lines, which was denigrating to both the New Age ideas and esotericism and, you know, mysticism in general. So unfortunately, a lot of people today have the idea that it's some sort of self-delusion or dreamy unreality or something false. Speak to both of those, if you can, the idea of what you think mysticism is and maybe some of the misconceptions today.
Well, sure. I maybe felt guilty of this in my younger years. When you think of a mystic, you think of somebody who was a little removed from society. He's probably a guy with a strange beard. He's not really here. He's a little in the clouds, and it's just ephemeral and, you know, mist, like the actual mist vapor in the air, that it's, you know, not really a cloud. It's not really rain. It's just this kind of foggy netherworld that is inhabited by, you know, mystic thinking, and you're lost in the clouds or pie in the sky, somehow removed from the world. And that is pretty much exactly the opposite of what a mystic is as far as an approach to religion or spiritual contact. Whereas in a dogmatic or cultic, and I don't mean cult in a bad way either, that word also has been kind of screwed up. Cult really comes from cultivation, to cultivate, your spiritual discipline and practice. Whereas a mystic, it's not, well, to use maybe a Christian mystic, for example, in maybe mainstream Christianity, you have to believe in Jesus being the Savior, and you have to have faith in that, and that it's true, and there was historical Jesus, and, you know, is the one and only path and way to approach God. Mm. And you can take a Christian mystic, which is, in a way, it's a mystic is the mystic part defines, I think, the spiritual seeker more than if it's a Sufi or Muslim mystic, or if it's a Kabbalah or a Jewish mystic, or if it's an Indian or a Taoist mystic or anything like that.
Sure.
The mystic part, I think, is because it's the approach, and it really requires you to take whatever dogma or text may be involved with it. Like Buddhism is essentially, you know, mystic in its entirety. There's the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, but the only way it works is if you apply it into your life. And to me, that's what a mystic means. A mystic is someone who...
So it's someone more practical, in essence, someone that's taking action towards finding those truths and going beyond the doctrine and the dogma to find the universal truths below it. Is that kind of what you're saying?
And it's incredibly down to earth. It's,
yeah,
you know, does it work in your life? Are you applying these rules? Love your enemy. Okay. Sounds nice. And you can say that at church on Sunday. But the next time somebody cuts you off in traffic, or a business partner betrays you and embezzles your life savings, or a number of other tragedies and traumas that come at us, you know, creates these enemies and hatred and anger in our hearts, towards these people, but to, you know, maybe not approve of what they did, but at least, you know, send love out, because if somebody who does something that nasty might be lacking in love.
Sure.
And what does that mean? Or even just to try it. You know, a lot of times you don't even want to try something. But it is a discipline in that it's a practice, like martial arts, playing an instrument, anything athletic with sports or nutrition. You have to bring it into your body and use it. It's not about knowing and believing. It goes beyond that.
That makes sense. Yeah,
I know what to do, like, and I believe in this, and I'm going to apply it. And then see if it works. And if that works, then you have faith that this thing works, but it only comes after having tried it in a meaningful way. So that's a mystic approach, great, as far as I'm concerned.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah, that's fantastic. And it reminds me of, you spoke of Buddhism a little bit, and it reminds me of Buddha's saying about how you shouldn't believe things because a holy person told you. You shouldn't believe them because you read them in a book. You know, you shouldn't believe them because other people believe them, but you believe the things that you believe because you have direct experience with them. And that's, I think, what you get at when you talk about mysticism, that it's a practical knowing, and a knowing with a capital K. In other words, not a piece of information, but a embodied universal piece of wisdom that you've realized in the bigger sense of the word, realization.
Make it
that,
real.
Of that, yeah, you've made it real in your own soul. There's a great quote I wanted to read off of page 37. Again, really quickly though, let's tell the reader, excuse me, the listener, where they can read along with this if they want to follow along with us and they don't have the book. I will say this: you can get Meditation Disciplines and Personal Integration either on the PRS website or on Amazon or any other book site. But also you have that great source that you got yours from. And can you tell the listener where that is again?
Yes, the actual book is pulled from four separate articles that ran in the PRS Journal in 1962. And there are PDF and text searchable PDFs of all of these journals. It came out quarterly. For many, many years, it was called Horizon at one point, then he changed the name to The Journal, and that's which one these are from. So if you go to this website, it's a great resource well beyond this, but just to look through the pages of these Journal and Horizon, and before that it was called All Seeing Eye, these periodicals, that was the original source of these. There were four consecutive articles, and they became parts 1 through 4 of this rather dense pamphlet.
What would they actually look up to get these articles? What should they enter in to search?
The website is manlyphall.info.
Okay.
And it's very easy to navigate. It's been a labor of love from a gentleman who put this all together. And the scans of the PRS journals do have the approval of the PRS itself to do that. So there's nothing on the sly about it. It's all been approved by the
perfect. The That's official. Fantastic.
So it's a great source, and you can go
and what year,
that.
What, I can't remember what was the years.
1962.
And then they can go through and find these meditation disciplines and personal integration articles. They should be in there. All right, perfect. So let me go into my quote. This is from page 37 in the book version. It's a pamphlet. It's 76 pages. Page 37. There can be no real and adequate mystical concept unless the person has the inward realization that religion is a universal experience. As man goes into the deeper parts of his personal nature, he passes from the experience of the personal toward a recognition of a universal nameless power abiding in the innermost parts of his own nature. So he's going within to find God, or going within to find the absolute. It's a beautiful, beautiful quote from Mr. Hall. And that kind of leads us into the next portion of the book that we wanted to talk about. And that's the universal ideas shared by both the East and the West. First, quickly, we're going to characterize, because Manly Hall gets into this, a little bit of the differences between the approach to religion and mysticism in the East versus the West. And then we're going to talk a little bit about Pythagoras and some of the information that he shared and how that came about. So do you want to talk a little bit about East versus West in terms of how religion is approached?
Well, sure. I'll do West versus East. We'll go that
okay,
direction.
Okay, perfect. Absolutely.
Because that's the way I have it in my notes. I don't have to flip it around. So in the West, worship is quite often a public thing. Or it is in a church, but it's still a public. There's a body of people there. East, worship is more contemplative. Now there are temples and shrines and services as well. But it's more of a personal thing. It's something you can do on your own, as opposed to a group. The West culturally puts a lot of pressure, so to speak, on the worshiper, because a quiet, removed, contemplative life or a practice really runs against the prevailing wind of the culture, of the dominant culture. And that's, mm-hmm. you know, you're out there in the world, you want to move forward, you know, am I going to be successful? I have to provide for my family and all these things. There's more of an emphasis on that. So to pull back and have a contemplative practice in life, you almost have to go against the cultural direction. Whereas in the East, that's a lot more accepted. That's a lot more just normal. Mm-hmm. to have that part of your life and have that be valid. It doesn't compete with the culture. And these cultures still move forward and they still progress and provide for their families and do all these things that the West does. But this approach to worship is very different. So for somebody in the West to want to have a meditative discipline and a more mystical approach, it might be a little more difficult and take a little more doing, because it's not quite so supported by the cultural norms.
By the culture.
So that's another.
Yeah. That's a great
and
point.
And say another difference is also in the direction of prayer or meditation, like what we're having contact with the divine for. In the West, we want to be understood. In the East, there's more of an emphasis on just wanting to understand the divine purpose and nature. And on
that
also, a lot of our prayers are directed towards human endeavors, that I have this purpose that I want to fulfill and I want divine aid to help me in it. Whereas in the East, there's an emphasis on just uncovering and recognizing and coming in contact with the graces of the Spirit.
Very good.
Which is
very good.
Different than having it kind of now. The end result may, you know, be favorable as well. If you understand the graces of the Spirit and you feel this contact with the divine presence, that's probably going to make things in your outer world and life work out a little bit better. But it's a little indirect. You're actually going straight to Spirit and having that inform your mind and decisions and things.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, it's interesting because it kind of reminds me of the overall sort of difference in culture between the East. By the way, when we're speaking of the East versus the West, obviously there's no hard and fast rules, but just to, at the risk of oversimplifying this, probably everyone who's listening knows this, but in the East, we're generally talking about India, China, Japan, Thailand, the Eastern world, what used to be called the Orient. And in the West, we are talking about what used to be called the Occident, and Manly Hall uses both of those terms in the book. By we mean mostly in the West, Greco-Roman, Judeo-Christian culture transmitted through Europe and through the Mediterranean and the ancient Near East. So that's kind of a definition of the West versus the East. But one interesting kind of cultural difference that Jungians talk about is that the most Eastern countries and most Eastern peoples are more introspective and more what you would call an introverted personality, where they're more interested in the inner experiences of life versus the outer, whereas the West, we're more externally driven, extroverted type of a culture, where we're moving things and people around and making history, quote unquote, happen and things like that. There was a nice quote that Manly Hall spoke of about Western man. He said, because Western man is constantly engaged in some vast, all-consuming project, his prayers are inclined to beseech divine aid for human purposes, which you talked about in the differences in prayer. And I thought that was a great point. So that's kind of some of the interesting things that are different between the East and the West. Obviously today, you know, these are no hard and fast rules, and cultures change over time. And the Eastern ideas, meditation, yoga, and so forth have taken root in the West to a great degree today, much greater than even when Manly Hall was writing about these things, and much greater than when he was when he had wrote his first book, Secret Teachings of All Ages, when all this stuff seemed very exotic. So, you know, things are changing, and I think we are becoming a little more aware of the inner life here in the United States and in the West in general. So that kind of moves us forward into the idea of what I was speaking about earlier, how actually these ideas sort of propagated themselves throughout the East and the West. And I was wondering if you could share a little bit about that, starting in that beginning of that fourth part where it talks about the early 5th century and mid 5th century movements. Maybe talk a little bit about Pythagoras and how some of those things unfolded. If you can find that. That's a great section of the book, and I encourage everyone to read that. There's a really nice, concise history of how these ideas unfolded in both the East and the West and how they influenced each other. So maybe if you could speak to that a bit.
Well, sure. The beginning kind of time frame that he lays out is the sixth century, say that six times swiftly. And
yeah, right.
It's,
thank you.
In the 500s BC, or BCE as we say now. And that would include Laozi and Confucius in China. And it would include the rise of Buddhism. And if there is a historical time frame put on the Buddha, it's around that general region. And Pythagoras and the other pre-Socratic, that is reappearing before Socrates. So there's Heraclitus, Anaximander, Anaxagoras, and a number of other ones that flourished in the Euclid in that time as well. Even at the time, road at some point that trade routes having been established, and along with them, not just trinkets and treasures from one culture to the next, actually practices and beliefs and stories and, would have exchanged hands. And there were still at the time, what were they called? Mystery schools. These were the secret sects and groups, societies that held this knowledge. And the time when Pythagoras apparently traveled to the East, not exactly sure where, but he would have come in contact through some of these Eastern traditions and sworn to secrecy, and certainly where he got them from. And then when he brought those back and started his school at Crotona, there was
isn't the legend that he went to India and was initiated into the mysteries in India? I think I remember reading that. Does that ring a bell? Something along those lines. I mean, there's no historical
like with the Brahmins at Elephanta, I guess is called Mumbai now, Bombay then. But that may have even preceded Buddha or been around a similar time frame.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And, you know, quite possibly coming in contact with a very similar source. So I think it's fascinating through this that quite possibly that the rise of Western Greek philosophy and the emergence and adoption of the Buddhistic tradition in India may have sprung from the same branch, source, or at least have enough crossover. Certainly the time frame. Whatever was going on in the world, in the universe at the time, it seemed to be just an outflowing of philosophy and ideas.
A particularly rich sort of period of time where it seemed to have influenced a lot of cultures, and these ideas overlap. What's interesting is it sounds like what you're saying is that there was more of a universal source for a lot of these ideas, and maybe over time they sort of calcified into different expressions in the East and in the West, and the West, of course, being more externally oriented, took these in a different direction maybe than the East did. Is that fair to say that?
Yeah, that's a great point. Because once they've been then pulled back into their own respective cultures, yes, they would And in a way, they have to, or people won't pick up on it if it's completely foreign and doesn't fit in the culture. Even yoga today in, you know, the American culture, let's just call it that, it changed a little bit, perhaps yeah. quite a bit, and it's become a little bit more of a physical exercise. Yes, it's sure. contemplative. Yes, you're in balance and harmony, and you're using mudras, sutras, and breathing techniques that are ancient and authentic. It's expression, though. You have yoga studio, and it's, you know, it fits kind of the American sensibility.
Sure,
because that's what we need. Somewhat, if it's
It's a bit more.
It's just been adapted.
And adapted, sure. But
it needs to be, you know.
To denigrate it does.
Yeah.
But the other thing, just not to just get off track, but one of the things people forget about yoga is that the asanas and the actual physical efforts are merely geared towards readying one for meditation. And I think people forget that. So they'll spend, you know, an hour on sweating through a set of asanas at Bikram Yoga or wherever they go. And they don't end up doing the meditation at the end, unfortunately. They're too focused on the sort of physical part of it. But again, that's our Western culture. But at least it gives them a way to focus and to find physical expression to some of those inner ideas and so forth. So I'm not denigrating it when I say that, but it's a different expression of spirituality. And we do that with that reminds me of the idea of the sort of archetypal and then the particular or you know, kind of cultural variations on it. So you have, you know, an archetypal or universal idea, and then you have the localized expression of that particular idea, let's say if we look at it in the terms of the gods, you know, you have the idea of, like I spoke about, I think a couple weeks ago, so a communicative or, you know, a sort of a communicator between the worlds, like a Hermes or Mercury or in African Yoruba ideas, it would be Elegua. You have a sort of a messenger deity.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the more particular. And then the universal idea is, a messenger between the worlds, let's say. And it's a particular versus, you're right. So that's the universal versus the cultural particular of expression, but I'm getting off track. So getting back to this, that was a nice overview of that. And again, I encourage the listeners to read through that section in part four and get an idea of where some of these ideas come from and how they've been expressed differently throughout the years and how culture has shaped those. The next big chunk I wanted to get into is where he talks about mysticism and meditation and how those are locked together. And I'll let you talk about that in a second. Well, I wanted to say, to give a quote, it's a short one, but he says, Manley Hall says, mysticism and meditation have always been intimately associated. Mysticism bridges the interval between religion and philosophy. And I think that's what you were talking about before, about mysticism being more practical. You're carrying it over into your daily living as opposed to it being some sort of doctrine or dogma. And Manley Hall suggests that the connection is the meditation and the contemplation, and then that carries over into your actual actions, day-to-day actions that you're taking. Can you comment on that a little bit?
Well, that's one of the functions of meditation, is that through stilling and calming the body, and going deeper to calm the mind, you're pulled out of the world and the worldly concerns and fears and agendas and just multitude of things that we carry around in our inner life. And it's those things that are the obstacles to our connection to spirit and divine mind, is that this process of meditation, it doesn't really bring in spirit or turn up, you know, the divine presence. It quells all the things that are standing in the way, our own minds, the monkey mind, if you want to borrow from Buddhism, and just this stream of thoughts and conditioning and to get to maybe a more pure, relaxed state, then the gifts, then the voice through this messenger speaking from the divine to us, we can hear it then, because all the other static, all the other radio stations have been eliminated from the spectrum, and we have a much more clear channel of something that's already there. We just, it's been obscured by our
lives.
That's
a great way to put it.
And it needs to, because if you want to go drive in traffic and go get some groceries at the store and put up with this and that and try to get gas at 5 o'clock, you know, yeah, it's troubling. And you know, sometimes universal harmony may not be as present. So we have to be in the world.
Yeah.
We have to watch our feet. Sure. We have to. But we don't have to be stuck there. And the more we are stuck there, the less we're going to benefit from the graces of spirit and the wisdom of divine mind and hearing that voice and actually being heard. Our pleas often are sent off into the ether unanswered because they're either mixed or cluttered or just lost in the static of everything else. And that's what meditation does. It calms the water. And to use a pond as a metaphor, when the water is still in the pond, you can see clearly right through it to what's underneath. Things that were invisible before now become visible. And also on the surface, it reflects more clearly what's above it. So the mountain top will be more mirrored and more clear on the top. So it's a twofold thing. We can penetrate, but we can also reflect. And that's not an act. It's an activity. Yes, becoming still is very much an activity, but it's an activity of turning down mind activity, world activity, that we're so conflicted and
really
it's competing for our bandwidth.
Sure. So that makes sense. So it sounds like you're kind of clearing the channel to see something that's already there, you know, and it's a way to still the choppy waters of the mind, as it were. That was a beautiful metaphor that you used, to be able to see the truth. And I think one of the things too, that the truth that mysticism is seeking after, is to see that divinity within ourselves. So it's obscured by all of our, you know, pettiness, our ego, our fears, our angers and frustrations and so on. We can get some of those things out of the way. I think we can get at seeing who we really are, the sort of bigger, in the bigger sense, the capital, you know, the capital S self that's connected to the universe, connected to the divinity behind all this material existence and in and through all of this material existence, you know, the invisible portion of it, from whence everything comes. And I think that, you know, that's a little bit of a, that's a, maybe another difference between, say, mysticism and Orthodox religion. I think Orthodox religion and more doctrinal and dogmatic ways of looking at it would have you believe that belief and assent to certain beliefs is the key to God giving you favor, and seeing God as something outside of yourself that's a distance away that you may only see after you die, or you may only see if, you know, he grants you some sort of vision of himself, and, you know, specifically himself. In the West, we would use that term, whereas I think a mystic would look at God in less materialistic terms, more abstractly, and certainly not as being male or female, but containing both of the masculine and feminine divine qualities. And the mystic, I think, looks beyond that, looks beyond to the universals, past the particulars. So that leads me into the idea of Christian mysticism, which seems kind of at odds sometimes with traditional Orthodox Christianity. And I know that you in your vision had imagery which could be regarded maybe as Christian mysticism, or a Christian mystic symbolism of some nature. And I mean, you can talk about that a little bit more, but tell me a little bit about how your experience in the crash, which you talk about in your book, The Spirit in the Sky, you know, kind of informs your idea of what Christian mysticism is and how you see that.
Well, the This was in 1991. I was flying at an air show and had a problem with the plane, and I knew I wasn't going to be able to correct it. And I finally surrendered, called a matey on the radio, and between calling the distress signal and hitting the ground was maybe about 20, 25 seconds. Of course, it was a very intense experience for me, so the time expansion was in full effect, so it seemed more like it was 20 minutes than 20 seconds. And a lot happened. I saw a mystical vision of the universe, the galaxy. I heard a voice asking me if I wanted to live or die. And I, you know, eventually chose yes, because I thought it through. And the ground's still coming up. And then I was given a vision of what I knew I was going to be presented with, an image of what my life would be more like from that point on. And it surprised me very much. It was a very familiar portrait of Jesus. It was definitely a painting. It wasn't the person at all. I knew I was definitely looking at an image of a painting that was very familiar. Mm-hmm. And as I did, the painting came to life and turned to look straight at me. And as it did, it turned into my face as if I were looking in a mirror. And as shocking and profound that was, as soon as I got that image, it disappeared in a flash. And about 3 seconds later, the plane hit the ground, and I had that to deal with. But over the years, I've certainly thought about it and reflected. At the time, Christianity wasn't on my radar. As a matter of fact, I was very, very interested in anything but my culture's religions, you know, mm-hmm. Christianity, you know, Judaism, any of those, as long as it wasn't that, as long as it was something that I couldn't pronounce or it was brand new and exotic, I was very much interested because I really didn't like what had happened, what all these ones were. But this vision haunted me, and it caused an opening to where, as I went on in my studies, I found a little bit about Gnosticism or Christian mysticism, even mainly Hall, the way he spoke about, because he spoke about all religions and traditions, the way he spoke and wrote about Christianity. I was very much from a mystical point of view. I had a book called The Mystical Christ, so that was definitely his stance on it. And that turned something that was very disturbing for me into something that I could actually make sense of and incorporate in my life. Even the Apostle Paul said, it's the Christ in you that's the hope of glory. Quote from Scripture, from Jesus, attributed to the words of Jesus, that I and my Father are one. So this separation from the individual and the divine between man and God really isn't there. And in a mystical approach, that's what you're really doing. You're not really talking to God and waiting for an answer and listening. You're actually having to quote from the book, the conversation, or that there is, you're actually with this presence as an ally, as a friend, not some distant thing you have to worship, that it's so near and dear to you and it's within you that it's such a different way of looking at it. And this image really kind of spoke to that. It took me a long time to come around to it, but that's where I am with it now.
Well, thank you for the honesty and sharing of that that experience. And I hope that our listeners will pick your book up because it is fantastic and it does give some more insight into that experience. It's interesting because I'm looking at a quote on the paper in my notes, and it's Luke 17:21, and they're asking Jesus about where the kingdom of heaven will be found. And he says, neither shall they say, lo here or lo there, for behold, the kingdom of God is within you, is within you. So I think that, you know, there's a lot of scriptural and biblical evidence that would point at the kingdom of God or God or, you know, Jesus's own sort of divine the experience of Jesus, the Christ consciousness, if you want to call it that, is something found within us. And I think that's what the mystics were trying to find, at least the Christian mystics that we read today. And, you know, from days gone by, certainly. And there are obviously modern Christian mystics as well. Not as many because, you know, I think religion has become more of a an orthodox and doctrinal sort of thing, but there are certainly people today who do follow a path of Christian mysticism, even if they may not necessarily call it that. And that's, you know, a path whereby one is trying to be more inward. You look inward instead of externally for everything, and to find that presence and that divinity within oneself. And I thank you for sharing your insights in that. So the last thing that we want to touch on, and this is going to be very short because we're almost out of time, unfortunately. And this book is, of course, as we've said, very, very full, packed full of great information. And we have covered not but a tiny bit of it. But there's an interesting section where Manly Hall talks about science, philosophy, and theurgy. And I wanted to get into that just very, very briefly, maybe 4 or 5 minutes of discussion on that. So I'll start with his definition of science. And he makes these distinctions, I think, in order for people to see that these are different ways of looking at life: science, philosophy, and theurgy. And I'll explain what theurgy is when we get to that point. But science, we know, is order. And these are Manly Hall's words, is order, method, and instrument by which we can separate superstition from fact and opinion from justice. Science has its own peculiar limitations and is restricted to a region where its instruments are affected. In other words, you use instruments to see the objective world and look deeply into them and understand natural science and the goings on of the material world. And that's generally the realm of science, unless we're speaking of quantum physics or particle physics, where we get down into a weird, wacky world of non-materialism, non-Newtonian logic of its own. Philosophy, on the other hand, deals with the invisible, with values and so on. And the philosopher puts the invisible universe in order with the aid of reason. And then he says it's with defective reasoning that destroys the validity in philosophy. So you have to have good reasoning in order to see things clearly using a philosophical methodology. And then more in tune with what we've been talking about, the mysticism and so forth, this is the third route that he uses into knowledge. This is a more intuitive one, because he says the rational faculty has limitations. And for this reason, Neoplatonism introduces theurgy. And theurgy is just a ritual, meditation, or action, magical or mystical or otherwise, designed to invoke or evoke God or the gods. So basically, invocation is bringing within one's realm of experience, within the body, mind, and soul. And evocation is bringing an experience. Let's say you're trying to evoke a spirit or evoke a demon or what have you, if you're in some sort of black magic. So that's kind of the difference between evoking and invoking. But theurgy then is this methodology whereby one creates a connection to something divine. And that's the path of the mystic. You know, can you speak a little bit more about that and how that happens?
Sure. I would even venture to say that meditation itself, the act of meditation, is theurgic. It is theurgy. It is a
great point.
You're using theurgy when you are meditating, because it is the bridge. You can scientifically prove to yourself that if you close your eyes, try to calm your mind, focus on your breathing, maybe repeat a mantra or consider a mandala object, and you're quiet, your heart rate will slow and your breathing will become longer, that the interval between the in and the out breath will become more elongated. And that you can take your heart rate. I'm sure there's an app for it, or biofeedback. I mean, it's, you can tell it does work on that scientific level with the body. So it's an experiment that, once you can get into a very basic meditative relaxed state or listening to a tape or something for 15 minutes, you can check yourself and see, well, am I a little more relaxed now? Am I a little bit less stressed? And you can probably find that you will be. So it's a very much, you know, a little bit of both. It's kind of mystical and in the etheric sense, but it's also very practical in the scientific sense. And it opens up that doorway, I think, that we were talking about before, between, you know, our individual lives and the universal divine mind, that this is this pathway, this door that gets opened up because everything else is cleared. And that's even from the New Testament as well. It's straight is the gate and narrow is the way, that that you can't, the straight and narrow, you can't bring in all this stuff if you want to walk through the doorway to the temple of the divine, because there's no room for it. How can you meditate with God when you're upset about, you know, what your boss said the other day, or, you know, the guy that didn't fix your car right, or your neighbor that won't return your tools, or, you know, if you're bringing that into your discipline, God's not going to hear you and you're not going to hear him or anything like that.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah.
Or if you do, it'll be very tainted and kind of limited. It's like trying to grow a crop when you have all kinds of weeds and things, you know, you weed those things out so your crop can grow. It's ancient in its origin, but it's very here and now in our lives. And I think we can really take a lesson from it and try this other path, this calming, clearing doorway that opens up and connects us with that. So this
theurgic
discipline is really spiritual and scientific. It's kind of all at the same time, because if you're too into philosophy or philosophic thought, or say too lost in philosophic thought, you can have all these reasonable rationalizations and insights and epiphanies without really participating.
And that
doesn't vitalize. Yes, you may be right 100% about everything. Your conclusions and insights are fantastic. But if you're not really applying them to your life, they're kind of empty. As interesting and as wonderful as they are, they're not fulfilling really their purpose. And the same thing too, if you're just on the opposite end, if it's all about action, well, I'm trying to do that, then there's no contemplation or, you know, meditative sort of approach to it. It's just unfocused action.
That's a great way to put it. You know, I think then that kind of gets into the idea of balance. And, you know, I think why he mentions science, philosophy, and theurgy, or in the case of PRS, you know, philosophy, religion, and science, same thing. It's three different realms of inquiry that are all needed to live a balanced life. And I think one of the main points in this book, both parts one and two and three and four, that there's a practicality to mysticism that whereby one brings into daily living the things that are learned through meditation, through contemplation, through the study of spiritual books and videos and lessons and so forth. That in a sense, if you don't carry that over into your life and experience it and have some direct experience with the absolute, with the divine in your life, and then allow that to spill over into your actions, that it's really a lot of this then is sort of a, you know, it doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't flower. And I think that that's one of the most important things that Manly Hall brings up in all of his work, is that there has to be a level of practicality and practical philosophy, which actually unfolds in your life to make it better, to make you, you know, act in a more disciplined, positive, constructive, helpful way towards your fellow human beings and your family members and all of that. So I think far from being, you know, kind of going back to what we talked about in the beginning, where we think of mysticism as something fuzzy or muddy or ephemeral, it's actually a very practical discipline. It's just a very practical way of getting in touch with something that's invisible, that divine within ourselves. And I think this book is a really great way to orient you towards some of those practices and ideas. We talked a little bit last week, and you can go back and listen to the previous episode about the retrospection exercise of Pythagoras and the morning meditation that's recommended. And those are great ways of putting practical, putting this to work practically. Another way, of course, is just a regular meditation practice, which I teach about in my book, If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate. And there's a lot of great resources all over the internet about mindfulness and meditation. And really, it's about creating a practice for oneself that connects you to something bigger than yourself. So with that being said, we've kind of run out of time. I do want to give you a little bit more time to wrap things up in a couple minutes if you have anything else to add to it. But I think really just the biggest thing I can say is get this book, Meditation Disciplines and Personal Integration, or get the pamphlets, the journal issues that Chris talked about in the middle of the podcast. And it's on the previous podcast at the beginning as well, where you can find those. And I'll actually put it in the information when I post this podcast, where you can find this. But do you have anything else to add to kind of wrap this up, Chris?
Well, the title itself, Meditation Disciplines and Personal Integration, there's a lot packed just even in that. The book is not as clear on particular techniques as you are in your book, but the discipline is leaning towards, you know, dedication, that you're an enthusiast, that you are interested in this, being a disciple, a enthusiastic person who wants this, not discipline like you're being punished that we talked about last time.
Yeah, exactly.
And this concept of personal integration, and fragmentation is, I guess, the opposite of integration. That these, you know, pieces are broken up, we're divided in our lives, and then we have to divide our time, our resources, our money, our thoughts. We gave it the office. I don't have time for this now. There's only so much to go around, and these parts get thrown around. And I don't know if he actually got into this. Sometimes I get a lot of quotes misplaced. But what it comes down to in this, you know, personal integration is that all this stuff is already there. Your connection to the divine, your inner divinity, all these pieces are there. They just need to be dusted off a little bit. In Buddhism, they call your inner Buddhahood, that it's there. This gold is inside. And you just have to, it's really more of a process of clearing the other stuff away than it is, you know, trying to find something that's not there. It's not really approached from a feeling of lack.